Yeah, we'll talk about running on empty here in just a minute, because as we get into another discussion about the desert, I'm reminded that 29 Palms Highway in California, US 62, considered one of the, if not the deadliest highway in America. And also fraught with stories of people that never make it to the other side, start off at night and are expected to be somewhere in the morning. And somewhere in the desert, they disappear. And too often, it's women. Too often, they find the cars sometime later on, sometimes burning, sometimes just abandoned. And they never find the occupants. And it can't just always be a matter of running out of gas. It's the last place you want to be going without gas at any time of the day. We'll back into that in just a second with the author of 29 Palms, a true story of murder, Marines, and the Mojave. But if you missed the first hour, you can always go back, especially if you're a Coast Insider. Easy to do, 15 cents a day. Gotta love that. But it'll also give you a chance to hear the follow-up from last week. And then part of Kelly Carlin, who I enjoyed very much in the first hour. But also a reminder, too, coming up on June 9th, you don't want to miss the live events that are going on in Las Vegas. George is on the road. And he's also playing in Asheville, North Carolina, one of my favorite cities on the planet. That's August 25th. When he's in Vegas, I'm sure George will hook up with George Knapp, who's got the night off. I'm in for him. We'll get back to the show next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Deanne Stillman is a regularly published author whose work has appeared in Rolling Stone as well as other major publications, and includes the Los Angeles Times. Deanne, in fact, let me ask you, because the bio I have in the book is a little old. Where else are you publishing these days? Just so I make sure I get it straight.
Well, my latest book, Blood Brothers, was just published by Simon & Schuster, and that's about Sitting Bull and Buffalo Bill and their time together in the Wild West show. And part
that
of
was
it
just last year?
It's, pardon me?
Was that just last year?
Yes, that was published in 2017. And part of it takes place at Standing Rock, and it's been getting a lot of great reviews. And I'm also a columnist at the Los Angeles Review of Books, where I write a column called Letter from the West. I write for Literary Hub and a number of other publications. And I've written other books, and they're
sure
listed on your website, I guess.
Yeah.
And
they're all there. I mean, we'll talk a little bit about Desert Reckoning, a town sheriff, a Mojave hermit, and the biggest manhunt in modern California history coming up along the way. But it's obviously your book on 29 Palms that that got my attention. And I had originally seen you referenced in a column somebody was writing about women that had gone missing in the Mojave. And this whole idea of the Mojave Desert just kind of got me really thinking a lot about how there's a relationship between geography and some of the things that happen in that place that you can't. You could move those same people into another part of the country, and maybe the same tragic events that happened to them in the Mojave wouldn't happen to them anywhere else. So there's something distinctly about the desert. And I was reminded of that as I was reading your book, that there you often you even speak almost of a kind of it was sort of a almost using a satanic metaphor, almost talking about that the devil almost comes out of the desert at certain times of the year. Do I have that right?
Well, first I want to say thanks a lot for having me on your show, Ian. I'm a longtime fan of the show and what you're doing on it, and just very cool to speak with you.
Oh, good. Well, glad
and,
to have you.
So, yes, as for the nature of the desert, well, I think it has a split personality. There's plenty of Old Testament scenery there, which I like. And that kind of translates into a battle between good and evil, which is something that I explore in my books. And our wide open spaces have a lot to do with that. They fuel all sorts of fantasies and desires and ideas. And, in 29 Palms, I talk about how the desert has whispered to everyone from Jesus Christ to Timothy McVeigh. So, you know, I think if you're open for business, you can hear all sorts of things in the desert, and some of the messages are beautiful, and some are not. And if you're, you know, on the edge or unhinged, you know, you can find yourself doing all sorts of things or colliding with some unsavory characters.
There's a part here I want to read here. Spring fever reached its pitch in 29 palms, and baby rattlesnakes and tortoise hatchlings and young coyotes and all creatures great and small were emerging from their burrows and nests and skittering and clamoring around and outside of town. Another presence slithered out of the depths. Some people say that the devil lives out here. And I think that's actually a vibe that you can, a palpable vibe in when you're driving through. We're spending a lot of time in the desert.
Yes, it's definitely a vibe. You know, and again, as I said, if one is open to receiving a dark message, you'll receive it. I think in the case of the two girls I wrote about, Mandy Scott and Rosalie Ortega, Mandy, who was about to turn 16 on the night she was killed, and Rosie was about to turn 21 a couple of weeks later. They were important figures in the town, and they took care of each other and the girls in their circle of friends. Mandy's mother referred to them as the lunchbox gang because they were high school friends who used to hang out at her house during lunchtime, you know, in the middle of the school day. And that sounds kind of benign, but, you know, there are a lot of kind of fierce tribes in the town of 29 Palms. Bikers, Marines, Samoan gangs, Latino gangs, Crips and Bloods, and then here were these girls kind of banding together and becoming known as the Lunchbox Gang. And, you know, they came together out of friendship, but also a need to fend off all these other forces in town. Both of the girls I write about in 29 Palms came from a legacy of poverty and violence that went back for generations. In Mandy's case, to the Donner Party, and in Rosie's case, to a shack in the Philippines. And I follow their family's path into the Mojave, and they had come there in order to start over. You know, and that's the thing about the American West. You know, it's the great American promise. We have these wide open spaces where you can reinvent yourself. And a lot of the country's castaways end up there and running into a lot of trouble, and some of it is fueled by dark forces.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's this was a conversation I had with Ann Rule, the queen of true crime. And Ann Rule, I had the opportunity to interview her before she passed on, and I did the last couple of interviews, and her daughter and son-in-law remain very good friends. And but when I was talking to her, she talked about this relationship between the soil and the crimes that happen near them. And what she said was that you could never quite understand a crime, and especially the ones that she was going to write about, until you went to the place where they had happened, and you smelled the local flowers, and you had eaten the local food. And that part was also, it came to me when I was reading 29 Palms, because you talk about the I believe it's pronounced lumpia, the Filipino dish that gets made in this sort of, you know, in this traditional way, but also in how the sort of the ecosystem of the desert and this idea too, the relationship between geography and crime, it sounds maybe crazy by some people's standards, but I think there was an old show on A&E called City Confidential.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Right, hosted by Paul Winfield. And that was
yes. Every show started out the same way.
Yeah, it was a great show, though, A river, a storm, but a town. Like, what was unique about this town that gave way to this particular type of crime? And what was it about the people in this town that were formed by this community in the way it informed us about the way in which they reacted to murder or they reacted to different things? And that there's even a show on Netflix called Murder Maps, kind of follows the same idea. So I just, again, I'm looking at when I'm thinking about the desert and I'm thinking about all these things, and you just like hit on that theme exactly because of that, the recurrence of violence, domestic violence, generational domestic violence, and a kind of, well, you described it by talking about just even the kinds of people that end up in a town like 29 Palms. A lot of them are Marines or former Marines, but other people, as you talked about, like a town of like a start over town, a town of new chances.
Well, that's exactly right. And you know, it's a beautiful place. Joshua Tree National Park is there. And across Highway 62 is the largest marine base in the world. So there's this schizophrenia in the desert, you know, this contrast between extreme violence, you know, government-funded violence, as it were, and extreme beauty, which also, now that I think about it, is not funded, but I mean, it's maintained by our tax dollars.
That's an interesting idea.
So that all kind of goes to, you know, what are we doing with our wide open spaces? What are we doing in and on these spaces? And how do these spaces shape us as Americans? But let me just get back to your question about who lives in 29 Palms?
Yeah.
Who lives in these desert towns?
Right.
I mean, yeah, for sure the military is firmly established, you know, in these wide open spaces. And, you know, that's, you know, for one primary reason, which is where else are they going to carry out their maneuvers? I mean.
Perfect.
You know, they have to be there, really.
Right.
And in terms of other people who live there, it's people who there are a number of camp followers, you know, women who are working in service establishments in these towns, you know, at bars and bowling alleys and dry cleaners and fast food joints and so on. But there are also, you know, longtime locals who run inns and hotels and whose families have been there for generations and, you know, are descendants from some of the original homesteaders. There are hikers and, you know, explorers and asthmatics and all sorts of people who go out there for all manner of healing. And then there are these, you know, there are gangs who set up shop out there too. You can, again, for the same reason the military does. Where else can you do certain things and be left alone?
You know, you mentioned in the book about how that the Mojave and this area outside of 29 Palms, frequently the area where weapons are first fired and last fired. They're tested, and then frequently it's their last firing before they're completely discarded. And
well, yeah, I mean, I've spent a lot of time hiking the trails out there and elsewhere, you know, across the West, and it's, you know, I have to say it's certainly not unusual to come across discarded shells, you know, on many a trail.
Sure.
You know, one of the things I wrote about in my book Mustang, which is about wild horses in the West and the ongoing wars against them, and George Knapp, your colleague, has covered this situation extensively as well. That there was the incident that drew me into that story was the massacre of 34 wild horses outside Reno in 1998 at Christmas time. And I've been up to that site a number of times over the years, and it's become a local shrine, but there are still shells from that incident. You know, what is it now? It's like 20 years ago. There's still discarded shells up there. And you, and as I said, it's like a common sight across the West, and certainly, you know, in the deserts, in the desert outside 29 Palms, where there are all these military exercises. But yet all this beauty, you know, the Joshua tree is a personal totem of mine, and it's, you know, the wildflower blooms out there are quite amazing. And something I find pretty interesting, and I like to take a look at in my work, is that the people who end up running into a lot of trouble in the desert are generally not able to engage with the beauty of the desert. They're not able to find salvation there, which is pretty unfortunate because they're right in the middle of this, you know, gorgeous terrain.
That reminds me of
kind of devoured by it.
It reminds me of something you wrote. You said, senseless violence, the world calls it, but the Mojave knows otherwise. The Mojave knows, has always known, that the violence is not senseless. The disturbing acts that unfold on its sandy stage, in fact, make perfect sense. For that is the very nature of the place, to convey meaning, to show events in living color on a giant screen in bas relief, to make it seem as if everything is happening for the first time, even if for some it is the last. I thought that was really powerful, because that's really interesting idea.
I really appreciate your reading that. That's one of my favorite passages in the book, too.
Yeah, but I mean, that sums up this idea, too, because the margins of life just narrow for everybody under those kind of extreme conditions. And we'll get more into the story of the people that you wrote about in 29 Palms in just a moment. But that's that idea, too, that even for the like 10 months out of the year, you know, there may be no water, there may not be anything, but then suddenly the water comes rushing in, and all of these different species of toads and frogs come out of nowhere, because they've just been
desert frogs that live for decades under the sand without water. Suddenly
without water
pop out.
Yeah, they pop out, and they're dangerous as hell. They're poisonous. I mean, they're like, well, at least if they're the same kind that we get in the Sonoran, they are.
No, right. Well, just, you know, you can look, but don't touch. I mean, it's really like a miracle in the desert. There are so many surprises in the desert, but then there's this evil lurking. Something, you know, the place really informs people in every way, just as you were alluding to earlier. I mean, there are all these possibilities, but for people who are stranded there and, you know, are unable to don't see themselves as having a future, all of that stuff is really foreclosed.
Yeah, and that comes down to, again, what is sort of this inevitable clash in 29 Palms in your book, and in just sort of in general, what so often happens with these people under these extreme conditions, just like the frogs that are waiting to come back, or just like, you know, the evil, as you describe it, the thought that the devil, in a way, using that imagery, lives out there, that the slightest provocation or reanimation, and the people that are trying to do, you know, good, or people who are trying to live well, are up against forces of other people who are trying to just take whatever they want, because there's, you know, there's not necessarily a lot of authority around to stop them. And in the authorities that do exist, the police may show deference to the Marine Corps. There are some frictions in the town, and we'll get to all of those coming up in just a second. And in fact, I want to ask Deanne Stillman too, about this one passage. The women did not call the police. Women from Sonora never did. No one from Sonora ever turned anyone in, not ever. They took care of things themselves, because that's just the way it was. That was miner's law. I want to ask about Miner's Law. We'll do that coming up, and then we'll talk, too, about the book Desert Reckoning, and more about the story of these two women, a girl and a young woman, 16 and 21, and how their lives were forever changed by the Mojave. And I've got a list of some other people I want to mention who are currently missing right now out there, too, coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. All right, at Deacon Punnett is where you can find me on Twitter. And if I got space, we can even do the friend thing on Facebook. I want to get back to this conversation. We'll tell you the story. Now that we've set the stage, now that we've kind of pulled back the curtain on the scene, we'll tell you more about the tragedy of 29 Palms. And I got some people I'd like to put on your radar, too, that could still use a prayer. Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. A little ways east of San Francisco, Sonora, California, is about 7 hours north of 29 Palms. But it's another city where one of the families involved in this tragedy had traveled through. And I was captivated by this idea about Miner's Law, in a lot of ways, how similar the two communities were. What does Miner's Law mean?
Well, you take care of it yourself, whatever it is.
Whatever it is.
You know, there's that great old song, I Fought the Law and the Law Won.
Right, there's Bobby Fuller
law.
Four.
There was no law. Miner's Law was their own, you know, that means there are no cops to call. You're on your own and you fend for yourself. And, you know, that's kind of the way it is that was the way it was then, you know, on the frontier and in a lot of mining towns. And it is the way it is now in certain rural areas. You know, if you're in trouble and you need to call the cops, it might take hours for them to show up. So you really have to know how to take care of yourself. And people pride themselves on that sort of ability. It's not something that, you know, it's one of the reasons people are living in those areas. They want to be left alone and they want to deal with things on their own terms.
Hunter S. Thompson wrote a nice blurb for you on the book. It said, a strange and brilliant story by an important American writer. In the foreword for this book from T. Jefferson Parker, he refers to this event, which is the subject of 29 Palms. It says, Southern California city of 29 Palms, two friends, a girl and a young woman, were raped and murdered in a cheap apartment. They were poor and they were flawed, but there was goodness in them. They were stabbed 33 times each. 7 years later, a Marine stationed at the world's largest Marine Corps base just a few miles away was on trial. And that's what the story is about. What's interesting to me is it's a, you know, and I think this is true about true crime, is that these stories are timeless. You know, this could still be going. This could have been another story, although it's unique and you tell it beautifully. It's not as though this was a one-time thing in a town like 29 Palms or in an area like the Mojave.
Well, I want to say that when my book first came out in 2001, and there have been several editions since, most recently the latest Angel City Press edition, I was drawn to the story after I had been hiking in Joshua Tree National Park one day and was very familiar with that area, a longtime pilgrim in that part of, in that neck of the desert. And I went into a bar for a drink and I heard two people gossiping. I heard several people actually gossiping about these two girls who had been, quote unquote, sliced up by a Marine. And I, that got my attention. And I asked around, I asked these people who were these girls? And they said, oh, just some trash in town. And I was very disturbed by that comment. I knew, quite a bit about the kids in town at that point. I knew, you know, that the Marine Corps was the main employer in the area, and tourism was the number two source of income, and that the Marine Corps kind of called the tune. and that people, were often having problems with the Corps on account of its, its supremacy in the area. This description of the girls was just quite upsetting. I knew then and there that I wanted to give them a name and tell their stories. I've said this in a number of interviews over the years. There, when I heard this, I felt like I had been, like I the statement rang me like a church bell. Really,
right?
It just it resonated and up and down and in serious ways. I mean, I had my own strange riches to rags upbringing, moving from an upper middle class neighborhood in northeastern Ohio to a working class neighborhood, and that was after my parents had got divorced, and we immediately became part of this far-flung, voiceless community, apparently, because even some relatives of ours stopped talking to us when we found ourselves on the wrong side of the tracks. So I had this, suddenly we were persona non grata, and I had this long-time identification with people who are voiceless and not listened to, and especially girls. And that's who I knew right away, that's who the people in the bar were talking about, girls who, who I had no doubt had, were integral to the community, but were, scoffed at in this bar.
Right.
And so I embarked on the trail and wanted to retrieve their bodies and give them a voice.
I think that's, again, to evoke a conversation I had with Ann Rule, the queen of true crime. That was actually her motivation from the very beginning. She said as a little girl, she used to read true crime magazines on her grandfather's desk. He was a sheriff. And the rest of the family used to say, "Oh, Anne, don't read those because they'll only give you nightmares." And she said, "I slept very well." But she said, "I was fascinated by these voiceless women." And she didn't really think of them as real. She saw them, and this is her quote, and I use it myself in something. She said they were like rude fairy tales. And I think that that's what true crime does so well, is that it continues the tradition of folk tales, which are fairly timeless stories that convey a warning or a danger, especially to young women. And if you really think about most folk tales, they're really centered around youth and women or girls who are approaching womanhood. And
well, that's an interesting point. Yeah, like the Big Bad Wolf is out there.
Big Bad Wolf, Bluebeard.
Sorry, go ahead. What
I was going to say, Bluebeard, and any of the, that all of that. And that's where, to me, again, this story falls right in line with this idea. 29 Palms, a true story of murder, Marines in the Mojave, is that you it really is a cautionary tale. And it helps to explain a very difficult and kind of dangerous part of the country for girls of that age.
Well, the thing I get into in my book is the fact that, back to the Marine Corps being the main employer in town, every 2 weeks on Marine pay day, I don't know if this applies nowadays, but during the 10-year period that I was working on my book, it did, violence spiked every 2 weeks on Marine pay day, and that was the night that the bars used to have dollar drink night. And that's the night that Mandy and Rosie were killed. The guy who killed them was a Marine with a history of sexual assault against women before he joined the Corps and while in the Corps. And 6 weeks before killing Mandy and Rosie, he had raped the daughter of a sergeant major on the base. But he wasn't confined to the base on the night of the murders because he was a star on the Marine basketball team. There are a number of similarities between the story I tell in 29 Palms and the OJ case. Mine was sort of a down and dirty OJ involving this athlete who was given a lot of slack on account of being important to the Marine basketball team.
Or even in college, right? I mean, he was an athlete in college.
Yeah, and apparently courted by the NBA and so on.
Yeah.
But, I mean, to this day, I get calls from women now who knew him then in the Marine Corps, and this was during and after the Gulf War, don't forget. To this day, I get calls from women who say, oh, my God, I just read your book, and that guy attacked me like 20 years ago. And actually, several years ago, my book helped cops make a cold rape case against this guy who killed the girls. And it was another incident, but and he was already doing time, started doing life without parole for killing Mandy and Rosie. But there was this other incident. But my bigger point is that I was telling this very urgent Me Too story, you know, way before. I mean, here there were girls at risk and who had had these violent encounters with this guy and were trying to call him out way before. They were saying Me Too, but way out on a limb with those sort of statements because there was no, you know, women coming forward, even like 10, even, you know, in some cases last week were excoriated for doing such a thing. The tide is beginning to shift on that front. But one of the girls in my book, Tammy Watson, this daughter of the sergeant major who was raped by the killer 6 weeks before he killed the girls, had tried to do something about it, but didn't want to embarrass her father, you know, this somewhat prominent figure in the Marines at that time. It was very, very difficult for women to come forward with these stories then.
And it's just so wrong.
Ended up on a double date with Mandy's sister after the murders, and it had just been announced that this guy who had killed Mandy was arrested, and she picked up the newspaper in the middle of this date and saw his picture and said, oh, my God, that's the guy who raped me 6 weeks ago. And she ended up having to tell Mandy's sister the whole story and blamed herself for not trying hard enough to convince her father and other Marines to do something about this guy. A very urgent Me Too story, you know, way before this phrase has come into use.
Sure.
But I, you know, I get into all of this in my book.
Yeah. Well, it's like cautionary.
Class and gender and rape culture and the military and the whole American shebang.
Right. Well, and that's why, you know, again, so part of what brought me to this book and to you was the research I was doing for a potential TV series about women missing in the Mojave. And it is obviously bigger than this, but this, you know, you articulate the case from beginning to end. And in some respects, 29 Palms is the exception in that we know who did it, and then justice was served. And too often, the truly scary part is that there are predators that are working out there who, you know, going west of Las Vegas, which it's certainly I'm not the person that originally made this judgment. I'm just passing it along that, you know, that's like the Arlington Cemetery for the mob, that there are just, you know, uncountable number of graves that are out there in the Mojave. And that some of the other names, like I found this one columnist who had been tracking some of the women who were missing because nobody else was. The newspapers can only run a story and then maybe an annual kind of, hey, we're still looking for. And you get your kind of the milk carton type of an update or something, but it doesn't necessarily shake the Joshua tree for new clues, right? And so I contacted this columnist, and she'd been writing a blog, and I just sort of started an email conversation with her. And then I followed it up a few months later, and she, as I mentioned last week, she said, I'm out. She said, I'll send you what I have. I don't ever want to talk about this again. She said, as soon as I started writing about it, she said, my life got weird. And she said, I hope I'm just being paranoid, but she said, too many strange things have happened on my phone, around my house. She said, it's like people don't want me to keep stirring the pot on these missing names. And she said, she asked me to never mention her name, but she sent me the list, her most current list of the missing girls and those that are deceased, but still have yet to find any justice from the desert, according to San Bernardino in Riverside County. Christine Hamilton, missing. Christina Batten, missing. Christy Stewart, missing. Christina Bastian, missing. Sandy Giles, deceased. Stephanie Dixon, deceased, but no adjudication on who did it. Jovita Colazzo, Jennifer Kinsella Grindle, Diana Rojas, Lindsay Starr Roman, Catherine Barrett, April Pitzer, Margay Edwards. And this is just an abbreviated list, including the Jane Doe from San Bernardino, the woman's head they found in the backpack, and they still haven't been able to identify her. And I think that was mentioned in a Vice article that you were mentioned in too. Does that sound familiar?
I remember that piece. I was quoted in it regarding the girls at 29 Palms. But right. I mean, for sure, girls, and especially, you know, those who are. Well, let me backtrack for a second. I've often said that another title for my book could have been Where's Dad? Because a lot of the kids I write about in my book, and including boys too, their fathers were either deployed at war or in jail or drunk or wasted or just not around. So you have many cases where single women, single mothers are taking care of kids and kind of these and kids who aren't necessarily theirs, kids who end up coming over because their own parents are deployed, and these sort of unlikely families form, but often headed by single moms. So you know, you have a lot of at-risk people just kind of hanging on by a thread who end up colliding, say, or depending on the Marine Corps for better and for worse. They are like regarded as the rich guys in town. Some of these girls end up marrying Marines as a way out of their circumstances. And in fact, the two girls I write about in 29 Palms came from military families. You know, they have a lot of the kids out there have come from a heritage of military service, and well versed in it,
right?
And not necessarily a bad thing.
Sometimes no,
it's very very good thing. And I have to say that there were a number of Marines who I couldn't have written my book without Marines. They cracked this case, and there were a number of Vietnam vets in particular who helped me, who kind of guided me through town. And there was another Marine who was sort of a de facto dad to a lot of the kids I write about in my book, who ended up, when he left the Corps, ended up running the local arcade out there and was sort of ended up taking care of a lot of these sort of wandering kids and was
the strays that you write about. In fact, let's pick that up, because I'd love to have you tell the story of how the Marines helped you in cracking this case, 29 Palms, a true story of murder, Marines, and the Mojave. I think it says a lot about what the point that Deanne Stillman was just making, that it was an exception to the rule when a dad or a stepfather didn't beat the mom, and that you had whole generations of two or three fathers in a house, and each one were doing the same thing. But how did the Marines help? Well, I'll tell you next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.